Welcome to Be Customer Led, where we'll explore how leading experts in customer and employee experience are navigating organizations through their own journey to be customer led and the actions and behaviors employees and businesses exhibit to get there. And now, your host, Bill Stakos.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Be Customer Led. I've got a very, very special guest for you all this week. Tiffany Bova is an amazing individual, by the way, if you don't know who she is. So one, she's got a day job, which is Global Growth and Innovation Evangelist for Salesforce. You may have heard of them. She is also a Wall Street Journal best-selling author, Growth IQ. We're going to get a little bit into the book later on in the show. You have your own podcast, What's Next, which is an amazing show. Myself, a boy, can only dream. If you guys aren't listening to it, you absolutely have to put this on the download register, please. Tiffany, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to have you on.
Oh, thank you, Bill, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So let's just talk about, I'm always curious in people's journeys and where they come from, how do they get to where they got to, et cetera. So, I mean, go back as far as you like, but like, you know, you have this incredible career. You know, I'm sure our listeners want to know, like, how did you get to where you are today?
It wasn't a straight line. I didn't know where I was going. So there was no sort of end goal, if you will. It just sort of unfolded. But I'd say everything I learned about business, I learned at the carnival. And like people go, wait, what?
That's what I'm saying right now.
Right. So I was born and raised in Hawaii, and my best friend's family owned an outdoor carnival, you know, Ferris wheels and roller coasters. Wow. And outdoor games and all of that, and then had indoor arcades. I'm going to date myself now, but, you know, sort of back in the 80s, the 1980s.
I know those days.
Yeah, there were indoor arcades, right? So you would go and play video games. You didn't have them on a cell phone or, you know, virtual reality or anything like that. So I started working for the family at sort of, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. So when I was back and forth from college, and the, her mom, was one of the very first, presidents of YPO for the chapter in Hawaii. And so I had, you know, someone I could see I wanted to be, right, from a business perspective. And she really took time to explain to me and teach me so much about business that that's why I say everything I learned about business, I learned at the carnival. And I still apply a lot of those lessons every single day when I, you know, advise clients, but also when I was a practicing sales, marketing, and customer service leader. So from, you know, the carnival, I kind of accidentally found my superpower was in sales, accidentally found technology. So those two things happened simultaneously in kind of the rest is kind of history, if you will. But I started out as an individual quota bearing sales rep, you know, and slowly moved my way up. And in my 30s, I changed jobs every 18 months. And people who were hiring me would be like, are you a higher risk? Like, why do you keep leaving where you're working? What's wrong? Is it you? You know, and I'd say, I actually wanted more. I wanted more challenge. I wanted more responsibility. I wanted to learn. I wanted to stretch. I wanted to grow. I didn't want to get comfortable. So I changed jobs. And with each of those adjustments and changes, I took on more responsibility and more responsibility. And then my final real sort of sales, marketing, customer service job, I was running a division at Gateway Computers. And then I landed at Gartner, which was a complete 180 for me, right? Being a practicing sales leader to being an academic. It was, I played one at work for a decade for sure, because I am not an academic in that way. But all of those experiences gave me such great insight when I was an analyst to really connect with people who were clients. And then I found my sort of second superpower, which was being able to take lots of data points and find patterns and be able to tell that story in a way that would inspire people to think differently. And so, you know, Salesforce came to me and said, hey, we want you to keep doing what you're doing, but we want you to do it for us. And I said, what a great opportunity to once again sort of stretch and learn and find what was going to happen next for me.
So what What an amazing asset that must have been for Gartner, though, right? Because you had real world on the boots ground versus an academic. No offense to them. I have a lot of friends there and they're all great people. But you know what it feels like at the coalface every day because you're talking to clients. Then bring that experience into more of an analyst role. I mean, you must have created a ton of value there for them, I would assume.
I did. And you nailed it. You know, while I might not have had the responsibility at the scale they did, because, you know, sort of the largest 10 tech companies in the world were big clients of mine. I helped them with their go-to-market transformations, their channel strategies, right? Like, you know, it was very embedded in a lot of their organizations. So I didn't have a $6, $7, $10, $15 billion quota. But, you know, I still understood the challenges that you would face day in and day out. So I'd been a channel chief, right? I'd run sales, marketing, and service, as I said. And so I think that was what was unique, was I had actually, quote unquote, done the job, even though, once again, not at the scale. And so when they would say little things, I understood the sort of tension between the question and what the answer might be. And that definitely separated me. You know, I wasn't just an academic who studied. You know, it was not a those who can't do teach. It was I did and I learned. But once sort of year three, I made the shift. I actually ran out of things that I knew. So I had to start to become this student of the profession and just consuming and absorbing as much as I could from around the globe. And then I realized that I was seeing patterns that I never would have seen had I been a practitioner, right? Because you were very myopically focused on your own business. Yeah. And so kind of year three, it really changed for me.
That's interesting. So, all right, I'm already like thinking like, how do I get you as a mentor? Because I just joined Medallia 6 months ago after being a practitioner for 20 plus years. And now I'm in the same thing, right? It's more, more thinking about like broad term trends, go to market strategy as well. Now I've created strategy in the past, but you know, not at such a level in such a way. So, a lot going through my head right now, but we've got a show to go on to. So I want to make sure that
all right.
we're getting the most out of you here. So I know you talk a lot and you think about, you know, just helping companies grow and innovate in your current role. Future of work is a hugely insanely important topic right now. What are you seeing as some of the best practices for companies as they're talking about return to work even? Let's not get even to future of work perhaps just yet.
There's a couple of things. Sort of when the pandemic hit, we kind of saw three motions. We saw the stabilize motion. How do we stabilize the business? Like, oh my gosh, all of a sudden the doors are closed. Everyone's working from home. How do we serve our customers? How do we keep revenue coming in the door? How do we keep leads coming in the door? Like all the things that we already know have happened, right? So, but globally, the stabilize was happening at different paces and different speeds. In the first 30 or 60 days, it was kind of a consistent, but then things started to open back up and then it might lock back down again. And so it was in and out of stabilize, if you will. The next sort of phase was back to work, just to your comment. And and I often joke, well, I never stopped working. It's just where I was working had changed, you know, obviously. In 2019, I flew 275,000 miles or 600,000 kilometers, gave 100 keynotes on six continents. And then, you know, 2020, March 10th, I'm in Sydney, Australia for World Tour Salesforce in Sydney, which we pushed with a week's notice to a virtual event. And I squeaked back into the US 2 days before there were no more international flights. And then, so I've continued to work, just working differently. And the third phase is this back to growth. Like getting back to going, okay, we've stabilized, we've got people working. Now, how do we get back to revenue generation? And those three phases had very different responses and understanding of what needs to happen. Technology investments, right? More digital transformation in 3 or 4 months than we'd seen in the 10 years prior, sort of in the early stages. There were some SMBs in our recent SMB study that showed that there was some 54, 55% were not online at all pre-pandemic. So forget commerce, right? Forget doing anything, order online, you know, pick up in store. They weren't online at all. And so it really put a spotlight on the lack of technology investments pre-pandemic that now, hopefully, right, people have realized the importance of them because consumer on the B2C side and customer on the B2B side is very different with different expectations. And so I feel like, you know, now we're at a, okay, now how do we bring the human back into the story? whether that be field selling, whether that be doing service calls in someone's home, whether it's real estate, whatever it might be, how do we reintroduce the human and the human to human connection in a safe way, especially when it comes to, employee safety, whether it's retail or even, selling technology, whatever it is. At the end of the day, you have to make sure you keep, your employees safe.
Yeah, I agree. But when you think about sort of the proliferation of digital to engage customers, to engage employees in completely different ways than we've been used to ever, how do you see that impacting the customer experience? I want to get to the employee experience too, because let's face it, people rush to digital. There's a lot of tech debt out there now because of that fact, right? They had to create a solution to create a solution, whether it was the best one, to be seen, I guess. How do you think that has impacted the customer experience? And do you see companies differentiating? Because there were a lot of them really investing in digital before the pandemic. It feels like those are the companies that have really thrived through maybe the pandemic. I hate to use that word given sort of everything we've come through, versus others who maybe had to catch up, rush to a solution, and now maybe having to take a step back and say, okay, if we have to build this all over again, what should this look like?
Well, if the recession sort of 8, 9, 10, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, right, is any indication, those that came out the other side of the recession were making investments while they were growing and making investments through the tough times. And that gets hard as the company is smaller and smaller and smaller. They don't have the capital to actually do that. And so taking the monies and the opportunity that governments around the world have offered up to small businesses was a great way to help them leapfrog, where they were to where they're trying to get to compete on a different playing field, which is one that you called out, is experience. I was part of the team at Gartner that made the prediction that the chief marketing officer would spend more than the chief information officer on technology. And it was like, blasphemy. Oh my goodness, how could you possibly say that? But lo and behold, Microsoft, SAP, Oracle, and Salesforce went out and bought technology companies to satisfy learning that the CMO was going to spend money on tech. And it wasn't about just, email marketing. It was really about this experience being this new competitive battleground. And so from research in my past life and research now, we see it's like 84-86% of what a customer makes a decision on is actually the experience they have with the brand or the person, as it is on the products and services that they're purchasing. So I often say, if you went to a restaurant and the food was really spectacular, but the service was bad, would you go back? If the food was great and the service was great, would you go back? If the food was, okay, but the service was spectacular, would you go back? And the answer to those three starts to uncover that it doesn't matter how great the food was. If the service was terrible, I'm not going back.
That's right.
Michelin star restaurant or fast food, doesn't matter, right? So, understanding the power of that experience changes the game when experience at scale is hard to do with a human and a human alone. Because that experience now, the definition of that has changed. And so thinking, for example, if a small business wasn't online and now the customer wants to do something online, even open a ticket, return a product, get a quick question answered via a bot in a chat window versus waiting for days for a human to answer an email. Those kinds of things now are not going to go back to the way that they were. So now the question is, how much and how far do you make the investments into this digital kind of engagement without losing that human touch? So for me, the power couple is human and tech, not human alone, not tech alone. It is really the combination of those two things.
So how do you think about or counsel maybe organizations you're speaking to, Tiffany, in terms of, okay, tech's a big part of this, but it could also really get in front of that human relationship. I mean, what is that balance for you? What does that need to look like? Because I struggle with that myself. I'm sure a lot of companies out there are too.
So I'm going to use my Gartner example, the 3-year mark, to answer this question.
Yeah.
I would have answered it like, this is what I think. Kind of year three, right? I realized I was doing a disservice because the answer lies in, I don't know brand A or brand B or brand C, what the answer to that is. Your customers know the answer. So what are your customers saying? And usually when I would come back and the question would be, how do we do what you just said, right? And I'd say, well, what are your customers saying? And sometimes they'd be like, well, we surveyed them and they said, and I'm just like, that's kind of a, you know, a lagging indicator. What maybe will they want next? So I would go to use Salesforce in this example is when the pandemic first hit, it was probably our fiscal year started February 1st. So like 6 weeks later, boom, the strategy for 2020 was completely blown up, as with everybody else. And Mark Benioff, our CEO, gave us a challenge. He said, I want to have 1 million conversations with customers, not 1 million sales calls, not 1 million demos, not 1 million RFP responses, 1 million conversations. We're going to do it in a structured way. We're going to capture the conversations in a way that allows us to look for what are they going to need to stabilize, get back to work, get back to growth, right? Across those three pillars I mentioned a few minutes ago. And lo and behold, in classic Salesforce form, we had 1.5 million conversations. Now we're well over 6.5 million because he goes, this is really great. Let's keep doing it. once again, classic, you know, Salesforce form. So through those conversations though, we realized what the experience may look like between us and our customer, but more importantly, between our customers and their customers. And what does our technology actually have to do now in this, you know, reality that we were facing? And so we reorganized parts of the company on the product side. We changed around the product roadmap. We launched 6 new products last year, including work.com, which was all about getting people back to the office safely. We did a partnership with CVS, not about using our technology, but about testing and contact tracing and eventually vaccinations feeding into work.com so you could do scheduling. That all came out of those conversations. So to answer your question once again, ask your customers. Now, if you say, what do you want from us? Do you want a car? They go, no, we want faster horses.
Yeah, that's right.
Do we want, you know, do we want to listen to music, or do we want 10,000 songs in our pocket? There are pros and cons of asking them what they want because they might not know. So you have to become a master asker, asking the right questions in the right way to uncover the jobs to be done. And then that's how you can map back on those jobs to be done, exactly what kind of product roadmap you need to have. So that was a big answer, but the couple of things I want to highlight is I would have answered right away. Here's what I think you should do. But now instead, ask your customers, look for guidance. Doesn't mean you have to do everything they say. But if, you know, 80% of your customers, I'm going to use McDonald's, 80% of the customers or so were saying we want all day breakfast for a decade, but they added more drinks and more salads and more burgers and more this. They never introduced all day breakfast. They were in a full-blown growth stall, which is a story in my book, Growth IQ. And lo and behold, new CEO comes in and goes, we should do all-day breakfast. Like, oh my God, what a great idea. It's like, well, customers have been saying it for a decade, but you know, let's go with that, right? But the trick in that was that what happened after that wasn't the only reason. They did multiple things in order to be able to deliver all-day breakfast because you couldn't just turn on the switch. They had to reduce the menu, you know, fix the slow times in the drive-through, right? Reorganize the kitchen. There was lots of things they had to do. But then once they did it, what happened? Growth went like this. So sometimes customers actually absolutely know what they want. And other times they're going to tell you on the edges, the jobs they need to be done. And then that's how you can satisfy those.
I feel like that's a great parallel then also for the employee experience, Tiffany, right? You have managers or leaders moving away from being sort of the chief tell officer, like telling people what to do. Now they're listening again. They're trying to understand what their team's needs are and then figure out solutions about how to address those needs too. I mean, part of work.com, I was a customer in a past life and we had looked at work.com. Ultimately, the business decided not to go with it, unfortunately, but I went kicking and screaming for the record in that decision. But you know, part of work.com was not just facilitating sort of that return to work, but also just understanding from your employees what those needs are as well. So similarly to customers, are you seeing that as well from a leadership perspective and maybe some of the skill set changing because of the pandemic and, you know, this sort of mantra, like we need to understand from our customers what their needs are and then we can go develop. How are you thinking about that or what's your perspective there?
Yeah, I'd say everybody has learned a lot in the last 18 months around just transparency, communication, trust with their employee set. Once again, going back to what happened with us, you know, we would have quarterly all hands calls. We now have them weekly, literally weekly all hands calls. And all hands calls globally. So we'll do it in two time zones, you know, to try to be a little bit more respectful of the time, but it's recorded and on demand so people can watch it. Yep. But our entire ELT, so the entire executive leadership team, including Mark, and some members of our board of directors, even, you know, somebody like a Colin Powell, who's on our board, would join the calls. And you would be able to just sort of hear what's top of mind for them. What are we doing? What's happening? You know, and it was a way to bring the business together. And so now 18 months in, still every single week, and we're going to continue doing it even when, right? Because it's really been an amazing way to collaborate. And then with the acquisition of Slack, we have the ability to ask questions in the all hands call and they'll get answered and someone's tracking it and it's being fed directly back into the all hands call. Then we did something called Be Well, which was much more about mental health, you know, and having conversations. We were doing it internally. And then we decided to open it up to everybody. We did it live and streaming across the social platforms. And then we did something Leading Through Change, which was also internally. And then we made it sort of externally. And through that, you know, it might've been an annual survey or quarterly survey of employee sentiment. And now it's monthly. And we're seeing, you know, here's what's happening. You know, Mark went on, you know, television and said, look, we're seeing burnout in our people. Mm-hmm. And that came out of the surveys and here's what we're going to do. So I'd say equally the same amount of effort needs to go into making sure that your employees are happy, because the fastest way to get customers to love your brand is to get employees to love their job. Full stop, period. End of story. Yeah. Like those two things have to happen. And by the way, you know, in Growth IQ, I missed employee almost altogether. I sprinkled it a little bit, but it did not get its own growth path. So that's kind of going to be the next book. But I would say that through that, everything around what makes an employee engaged and satisfied and happy is different than it was 18 months ago, you know? So ultimately, you're correct, the same amount of effort, but I'd say there's been far more effort in, we are a customer first, customer driven organization. So what does that mean? Your employees are last or an afterthought? So I've actually changed to say employee first, and customer centricity. Then that way it gives them equal weight, but with different focuses.
Yeah. So truth be told, and I don't think I've even said this on a podcast, but I'm actually thinking about changing the name of the podcast, because when I started this, you know, over a year ago, I was, you know, Be Customer Led. That makes sense to me. But now it's really be experience led, right? Because it's not just about customers. You know, someone said, well, you've got customers internally. I'm like, yeah, but it still leaves employees or the workforce, even not just employees, but the total workforce out of the equation, which I think that is something that a lot of organizations are getting smarter about.
Yeah. And it's your greater shareholder community, your vendors, your providers in the supply chain, your partners, your employees, right? Everybody playing a part in that. It goes a long way. And I would say on stage that I didn't think it was a coincidence that Salesforce was one of the best places to work in the world. I think in 17 or 18 countries, it's number one. The rest of the world, it's in the top five or top 10. We're one of the most innovative companies in the world, and we're the fastest growing enterprise software company. I didn't think that was a coincidence. So I went to our prior CMO and I said, hey, I want to prove out this hypothesis. And by the way, it's not a new hypothesis. It's not like people didn't say, you know, Richard Branson has said it, Herb Kelleher has said it from Southwest Airlines. I mean, this is not a new concept, but I actually wanted to prove out the causation. I wanted to prove out the revenue impact if those two things were in harmony. And sure enough, we found through the research that we did that it was 1.8x faster growth rate. So for a $1 billion brand, it's $40 million impact. That's real causation. Wow. But what we also found was companies were either very employee focused or very customer focused, but not both. We also found that the investments made on the technology to track on the CX side, it's been high over the last, decade or so, because everyone's been talking about it. An employee has not necessarily kept up. So after that research, work.com was in the works at the time. And so they gave me a little bit more and said, go do a global study, because those stats I just gave you were US only. And so we just finished that. And so it's going to be coming out in the next couple of months. So I'm super excited about where we've been able to take this, because I think it's the right time for the conversation. The pandemic has really increased the level of interest in employee, and it's talked about all the time where it wasn't. Necessarily before, and not just employee from a productivity and an asset perspective, like humans are not assets in that way, but more in a health, mental health, well-being, skilling, reskilling. And because we weren't doing that in the past, that is, in my opinion anyway, the cause of this great resignation, right? People going, my employer doesn't care about me. They don't care about my mental health. They don't care about what I do. They want me to do. It's all about productivity. Like, I'm hitting eject, right? I'm out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that we're finally having really good, healthy, hard, and difficult conversations about employee at this point.
You know, that the employee experience piece, I've always known it's important, just kind of given the work that I do, Tiffany, but it hit real hard from a home perspective. As I was reading a research piece done by a consulting company, this is last year, maybe peak of the pandemic, it said something like pre-pandemic, 35% of employees said that their employer really focused on helping them thrive personally and professionally. Now, peak of the pandemic, that number was 50%. I'm like, hey, folks, where's the other 50, right? Like, it's exactly what you're seeing now that's manifesting in people saying, I don't want to be here anymore because I'm just a number, right? I'm just creating more sort of widgets for the factory, so to speak. I think that's going to continue to happen for some time, unfortunately. Let's talk about your book, Growth IQ. So you published this in 2018, so obviously pre-pandemic. You outlined 10 paths to growth for businesses. What's changed now? Like, now you're saying, hey, I'm going to write something that's a little bit more employee centric. But if you think about even Growth IQ and knows paths, have the paths changed significantly for you? Like, are you thinking about that differently? Maybe even just a little bit of a preview into the next book, perhaps.
So I'm not, because Growth IQ was very intentional. So because over the decade of me advising both startups, it wasn't just, you know, the Fortune 50, it was startups as well on how to grow. I realized the one thing about growth is it was never one thing. And I would consistently hear this: growth is starting to slow. You know, maybe it's been 2 quarters or 3 quarters. Should we hire more salespeople, spend more marketing dollars, or cut costs? And it was kind of the three levers I heard pretty consistently. And so I'm like, it can't just be these three. So in, you know, all the work around Growth IQ was really from the thousands of inquiry calls I took as a Gartner analyst, right? And all of the consulting days that I had done. And I went back to basics. Those 10, well, the 9 growth paths are just a modernization of growth strategies that have been out for 50, 60 years, like the Ansoff matrix. Sell more of what you have to new customers, sell more to new existing companies, right? That 4x4, that 2x2, I mean, that quadrant has been around since the 50s. What I did was I modernized it with, okay, but back then we didn't have social, mobile, cloud, big data. So I'm going to give an example. One of the examples in the book was Kylie Jenner. And, you know, so let's go back. Regardless of what you think the number is, let's call it 300 million she built, a half a billion, a billion, pick a number, don't care. Yeah. But she got to that number decades faster than some of the largest, you know, lines in the world, whether it be, you know, anybody, name anybody.
Yeah.
And she did it with 12 employees, with 12 employees. Now, why? Well, she has, I don't know, 200 million followers or 300 million followers, however many she has. Okay, so then you got social, right? It was the sort of the brand extension off the TV show. It was, she did partnerships with a lab instead of building her own R&D facility, right? She did all of these, and it was direct to consumer. It was not through retail. It was all these things that would not have been available 50 years ago or 30 years ago when other, you know, brands had launched. So what's the lesson there? So that's what I mean by modernizing. You know, how do you develop a product? Do you build it yourself? Do you partner? Do you work with an R&D facility? How do you launch a product? Do you, like, you know, do you take out a Super Bowl ad, or do you do something on social media? So you could deconstruct what happened. And so I would tell you those 9 paths are going to be consistent to the end of time. What's going to change is what's the next modernization step from what I sort of took it from then to now. The 10th step was, the 10th path was business being the greatest platform for change, right? Really trying to find purpose over profit and reimagining capitalism was the 10th path, which was one that had gotten more and more sort of, you know, interest over the last sort of 6, 8, 10 years. And so those 10, I would say, will always remain consistent. Customer experience, sell better, sell more to your existing customers. Like, you know, it's not going to change. All right. But what's different now with the employee lens was I didn't use that as a path individually. Like I didn't say, look, you know, if you don't have engagement, if you don't have, you know, high employee engagement and satisfaction, it's going to impact what you develop, how you develop it, how well people write marketing material or write FAQs or how happy they are when they're talking to customers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's really the extension and the stretch of employee experience drives all these other things, employee satisfaction with the customer specifically, which once again, always, always with a lens on growth. I'm not going to be talking about like hiring principles and like, you know, I'm really talking about it from an engagement standpoint through the lens of growth.
And do you think just sort of as some of those 10 paths, Tiffany, I mean, just digital first was, let's say the last 10 years, it feels like the next 10 or even, you know, the next couple, because we're in it now, is AI first, right? And how do you use automation to drive the types of experiences that your customers expect, but also the types of experiences that you benefit from as a company? At the end of the day, you've got to, you know, turn a profit and grow your business. How do you see that technology maybe changing and being as potentially another path for growth?
Well, I think data is very, very important, but data for the sake of data doesn't do anything, right? Yeah. So the statement, data is the new oil, I don't disagree with that, but you can't pull up to an oil rig and fill up your car. It has to go through the refinery first, which to me is analytics. And then the petrol or gasoline that powers the car is the insights. And so it has to do those three things, right? Data, analytics, and then the insights. Now, the trick is using those insights to actually change a behavior or change an action. And so next best action, the computer, the technology may push to a seller or a customer service rep or a marketer or a product developer, whatever it might be. Now, as the human, do I trust it? Do I go, I'm going to trust that AI, right? That insight is what I should do next. And now that becomes the challenge between the human and the technology, right? Is it always going to be correct? No. But it's going to be smarter and smarter and smarter over time as more and more data is analyzed, more and more signals are found. And so as humans, we have to start to find ways to work more closely with the AI, data, intelligence, insight side of the business in order to provide these compelling experiences, both for our customers, you know, and our employees. But one stat I'll give is this was a MuleSoft study, and I think it was the average enterprise has 900 apps. Or so average, right? And only 27% of them were integrated. So,
wow, that's an astonishingly low number.
Now, there are some, right? You know, finance, HR, legal, I'll never be integrated. So push those aside. But let's say you had 50% more or 40% more that should be integrated to help your people do their job, to have the customer have a better experience. You know, like takes me 10 minutes to get an answer I should get in a minute, and they don't have all my data. Why am I repeating this information 14 times? Like all that kind of stuff happens at that technology layer. And so that's why it's so important. And if there's a silver lining to the pandemic, it would be that these investments now have accelerated and businesses are understanding the power of how technology can really help them be more competitive.
Tiffany, I've got one more question for you. I know you're a busy individual. I ask every guest this question. It's always the last question. Where do you go for inspiration?
Usually I answer this on the road, because I have these incredible conversations with people backstage that are amazing to meet and learn and learn from, but also those interactions I have with people who are there that say, "Hey, I'm really challenged with this," or "We did that," or "I'm seeing this." I've gotten to speak at the UN twice. You know, I've done something at the World Economic Forum. Like those kinds of things are just so inspiring to me. And every single day when I hear somebody really trying to find ways to solve both, you know, social, humanitarian, planet issues, and business issues using technology, I feel like, you know, I've been in tech now for almost 30 years. I feel like, you know, I've played some small part in what has happened. And I say very small, you know, because I'm not a CEO, I'm not an executive, I'm not an entrepreneur, and I don't develop products, but I played a very small part. And that brings me joy because I love what I get to do. But I am inspired by everybody who is really just doing amazing things in business and in the world to just try to make it a better place.
That's awesome. Love that answer. All right, we'll leave it at that. All right, everybody. Tiffany Bova, amazing conversation. Thanks so much for coming on the show. We'll see you next week, everybody. We're out.
We're out. Talk to you soon,
everyone.
Thanks
for listening to Be Customer Led with Bill Stakos. We are grateful to our audience for the gift of their time. Be sure to visit us at BeCustomerLed.com for more episodes. Leave us feedback on how we're doing or tell us what you want to hear more about. Until next time, we're out.